The first reading this morning is not the easiest reading in the world. It comes from the remarkable, if unsettling, book by Margaret Heffernan called Willful Blindness. And it just came out this winter, about a month ago.
John Darley has written extensively about the degree to which corruption on a wide scale and evil on a wide scale require large numbers of participants and bystanders. Corporate meltdowns like those at Enron, MCI, or the banks require the work of thousands of people, all failing to see the moral implications of their work. You can't have historic catastrophes like the Holocaust unless millions of individuals have taken, in effect, the same moral shortcut. Under conditions of high stress, you may still have inklings, suspicions, but you may inhabit an environment that valorizes blindness, so you don't look. Who or what is it you are blind to? In the end, I think it's you, writes Darley. You become blind to yourself, to your better self. In 1938, residents of Mauthausen, Austria, were feeling optimistic. Their stone quarry was once again being worked, as massive rebuilding in Germany and Austria brought new business to the town. In nearby Linz, Austria, Hitler had great plans for his hometown, a new bridge, town hall, art museum, party headquarters, and two monuments, one commemorating the Anschluss, or the unification, one commemorating the late local composer Anton Bruckner. The town's economy was looking up, too, because the building of a new concentration camp created jobs and new business for suppliers and craftsmen. When prisoners began to arrive in August of that year, the SS tried to keep the population at a distance. But the camp was in full view, and ordinary life had to continue. Inevitably, that meant that the brutal treatment of prisoners was witnessed by bystanders. One was farmer Eleonore Gusenbauer, who didn't like what she saw, so she wrote to complain. In the concentration camp Mauthausen, at the work site in Vienna Ditch, inmates are being shot repeatedly. Those badly struck live for yet some time, and so remain lying next to the dead for hours and even half a day long. My property lies upon an elevation next to the Vienna Ditch, and is often an unwilling witness to such outrages. I am anyway sickly, and such a sight makes such a demand on my nerves that in the long run I cannot bear this. I request that it be arranged that such inhumane deeds be discontinued, or else be done where one does not have to see it.
The second reading comes from the Gospel of Mark, written around the year 71, just after the great temple in Jerusalem had been razed to the ground by the Romans. The author is unknown, but has been called Mark since the second century. It's been a while since I've used this particular passage, but I think it's one of the most rich in all of the New Testament by my lights, one worthy of revisiting over and over.
When they reached the port of Bethsaida, some citizens brought Jesus, a sightless man, and encouraged him to touch him in a healing way. So he took the man by his hand and led him well outside the walls of the town. There, after he had spit into his eyes, he placed his hands upon him. "Do you see anything?" he asked. The man was beginning to make things out, but he said, "I see trees, or are those people strolling about? I can't really tell." So he placed his hands upon him again, and the man stared intently, and finally he could make everything out clearly. But Jesus warned him, "Best now not to go back into town."
I'm wearing contact lenses this morning, as I often do on Sunday. They're special newfangled contact lenses. They have three prescriptions in them, and somehow they don't get confused. I don't understand it, but it works. But I usually wear glasses, as most of you know. I got my first pair of glasses when I was 4 years old. The doctor told me that I didn't see clearly. Although I didn't know that. I guess I thought that the treetops were always that fuzzy and blurry. I thought that's the way they looked. I didn't know what clear vision was. Others, I learned from the doctor, saw discrete branches when they looked at trees, like whips or harp strings or thin fingers against the sky. I didn't see any such thing. Still, even though I enjoyed the sensation of clear vision when the doctor was slipping those lenses in that little contraption as he was figuring out my prescription, I was not at all happy about this glasses business at age 4. Not happy at all. Not only did I realize I was going to have to wear these strange, weighty glass lenses on my nose and hanging off my ears, but I was going to be the only one on my block to wear the damn things. And in those days, my block was the whole universe, of course. And of course, all of my fears came true. I was teased mercilessly about wearing glasses, all the usual horrible names, and who likes to get teased? I sure didn't. So I used to take them off at night, and instead of putting them on the nightstand next to my bed, I would go outside. I would sneak outside, get a shovel, dig a hole, and bury them in the backyard. Now, of course, I don't remember ever doing that. To remember such a thing would have caused way too much guilt. I was aware that these things, these glasses, were very expensive. And some of you may remember that this was long enough ago that there wasn't any such thing as insurance. So the glasses were full cost. What I figure I did was to go into kind of a trance. And that way I could do this unconsciously and honestly say to my mother when she looked at me and said, "What happened to your glasses?" "I don't know." And I really didn't. So I got a new pair of glasses at least 10 times between ages 4 and 7. At 7, I really got interested in school and wanted to see the blackboard clearly, so I never lost my glasses again. How do I know that this happened this way? Over the years, as my folks turned over the soil in the garden in the spring to get it ready for planting tomatoes, they would find these old pairs of glasses 10 inches down. They were completely mystified, as was I. But clearly, unless one is to believe that some glasses sprite or demon was coming into my room at night, grabbing them and doing that burial work itself, it had to have been me who did it. But I lived in complete denial of what I did so that I didn't have to lie. But I did indeed do it. Now, you might want to know that since I told you a story about blindness in the first century, that if I had lived in the first century, I would have been considered blind, at least by the language. The word in Greek is ablepo, and it's usually translated as blind or sightless. But it refers in Greek not just to those people like Helen Keller, who could not see anything at all with her eyes, but also to people like me, who saw things distorted and blurry because he was nearsighted. The Greek word has a much broader meaning than the English word. Anything less than 20/20 was ablepo. That's why the gospel story you heard this morning has never troubled me much, even in my most deeply skeptical, rational days. The man in the story is ablepo, but that word could just as much refer to me as it could Helen Keller. Now, the story is intriguing to me for quite a number of reasons. One, you probably noticed that the teacher has to apply his healing touch more than once to this man. There is no abracadabra miracle here, or else the author would hardly have told us that the healing didn't happen right off the bat. The author, of course, lived 300 years before the strange theology of Nicaea, the Council of Nicaea, elevated the Jewish peasant healer into Almighty God, imbuing him with cosmic powers. The author of the gospel believed no such thing. Notice also that besides touching, he also uses ordinary saliva, spit from his mouth, which, although admittedly disgusting to us, was in those days considered, yes, even by doctors, to be a topical treatment for certain eye problems. Next, the teacher has to remove the blind man from his context, that is, the town where he's been living all this time, Bethsaida. And after the change in vision and he can make everything out clearly, this poor ablepo man is told that it's best not to go back to the town where he's been living all this time. That seems awful strange. After all, when I go to see my oculist to get my new contacts, I don't leave town. I drive right back home, put the little boxes of lenses in my cupboard, where I can find them. But remember, the author of this passage was not a modern person who might tend to think of a medical condition as a personal problem, an individual difficulty. In that more social time, a time when everyone in the intergenerational, multi-generational family, for example, slept in the same room on the floor next to each other, sometimes 20 to a room, the issue of privacy, personal individuality, which I know that I cherish very much, simply had not been invented yet. It's a very modern concept, this idea of privacy and individuality. And thus, for the author of the Gospel of Mark, and for all those who originally heard the story read aloud, the issue of not being able to see clearly was a social construct. It was a social situation. The blind person entirely had an identity based upon relying on his neighbors. He wouldn't have known who he was were he not in that context. His identity was in community, and he lived on the charity of that community and would not have understood who he was if he didn't have that charity. Therefore, if this man's sight actually improved, however you want to interpret that, it would not stay improved long if he returned back to the context which had supported him in his blindness. He would have become a blepo again. He would have to live in a very different way if he wanted to keep his sight. He would have to have a way of life, in fact, that would impose upon him terrifying freedoms he had not known before. He would have to fend for himself in a whole new way and within a whole new community where he could see things as they actually were and not have to be told what they were by other people who could see better than he did. He would actually be able to distinguish the difference between the fingers of a person's hand and the branches of a tree. We heard a couple of stories this morning. The other story you heard this morning, also from the Middle East, from the great Nasruddin collection, concerns a person who is sure he's going to catch a thief, a smuggler, taking things across the border. But the inspector can never catch this guy red-handed. Why? Because in his mind, the smuggler must have been taking something that he thought to be precious across the line, a jewel maybe, a hunk of gold, maybe an elaborate book. I don't know what he was looking for, but he had some image in his head as to what he was looking for that was precious that could be sold in the marketplace across the border. But he went through that bunch of straw and could find nothing. His eyes were working very well. I don't think he was wearing contacts or glasses. I think he had 20/20 vision. But he couldn't see what was right in front of him. What he didn't see was the donkey. He didn't imagine that it was the donkey that was being smuggled across the border. So he couldn't see it, even though his eyes worked just fine. Blindness, you see, does not always have something to do with the biological eye, with its nerves and its humors and its beautifully functioning lens. Sometimes blindness is in the mind or in the heart. After all, sight is not just a present, a gift of biology. It's a lot like the concept of freedom. It's something you have to achieve. It's something you have to deliberately seize, to quote Ignazio Salone. Listen to Helen Keller now. Blind and deaf since early childhood, she writes, I can see. And that's why I'm so happy. In what you call the dark, but which to me is golden, I can see a God-made world, not the world made by us. The God-made world she's talking about is the world she senses, sees, to quote her. The bark of trees, the warmth of sunlight, the scent of spring flowers, the feel of a bird feather in her fingers, the pressure of a friend's hand on her shoulders, placed there in tender greeting, the warmth of those palms pressing into her a kind of blessing, almost a kind of healing, like the famous teacher pressing his hands into the shoulders of the blind man. The world that she says is made by us, however, is the shambles referred to in the first and most difficult reading about the concentration camp in Mauthausen. Inmates are shot, but not always killed, and so they writhe in suffering until they die at the edge of Frau Gusenbauer's property. And so she writes a letter to the commandant in which she says, such a sight makes such a demand on my nerves that in the long run, I just can't bear it. I request that it be arranged that such inhuman deeds be done where no one has to see it. Again, the verb to see is used in several ways, just as in our reading about the blind man. In this case, however, the seeing places a demand on what she calls her nerves. In this case, she doesn't want to see it. She doesn't want to see. Take it somewhere else, she says. It's inhuman. Yes, I'll go with that. But I would just rather be blind and not see it. How often over the years I've heard the question, yes, what the Nazi party did was horrible beyond the power of any language, even English, to convey. But why did the good citizens there not do anything? Why did they not speak up? Well, personally, I hate that question. I really hate it. Why? Because it's a bigoted question. It's focused on one group of people as if they were somehow exceptional or different from everyone else in the world, including us. And so I would rather respond to that question with another one. Why bring up the good citizens there when such willful blindness is found everywhere on earth? Including, yes, here in the United States. Remember what Margaret Heffernan expressed before she started telling us about Mauthausen? She wrote, corporate meltdowns like those at Enron, MCI, or the banks require the work of thousands of people, all failing to see the moral implications of their work. Under conditions of high stress, she continues, you may still have inklings or suspicions, but you may inhabit an environment that valorizes blindness. And so you don't look. Who or what is it you are blind to? In the end, she says, I think it's you. You become blind to yourself, to your better self. Like the blind man in the Galilean town of Bethsaida, many modern people live in environments that valorize blindness. Valorize. That's a very fancy word for saying that some environments normalize blindness and even give it great value. There were thousands of bank officers responsible for the housing collapse by blinding themselves to what they were doing behind the scenes. But I don't see any of them in court. I don't see them in jail. There were thousands of American citizens whose moral blindness helped to ensure that you paid your taxes, but that General Electric, despite record profits, didn't have to pay a single dime. Not one. There were thousands of good people involved in helping the world to be blind to and thus effectively hide the $50 billion in Lehman Brothers debt. $50 billion makes the Ohio debt look like a trifle. Goldman Sachs hid the Greek national debt so that no one in the entire world could see it until it was too damn late. All of these are stories of willful blindness, people living in environments that valorize, normalize their blindness, and say it's okay not to see. The main point of my sermon is this. Just as sight is not something you get as a present, so freedom isn't something you get as a present either. Freedom, and I for one cannot improve on Susan La Follette's definition of that great word up at the top of your orders of celebration. Real freedom is the disappearance of advantage. Beautiful. Well-contracted sentence. Beautiful. Real freedom is the disappearance of advantage. Thus, just as you have to work to see, you have to work to be free. Work to help the great tide of advantage to ebb and ebb and ebb. And I think we have to work together, not alone. We have to reach out and touch each other, like the healer touched the blind man. We can do this, and we already do a lot of this around here, by telling our own stories of how we recovered our sight after we had lost it. Here's one. When I moved here from the Bay Area of California, the first thing I noticed around here was that there were very few visible homeless people. In San Francisco or Oakland or Berkeley, you could not walk a single block, not one, without tripping over bodies in doorways, without seeing plaintive signs, without seeing hands outstretched. Here, for the first few years, I saw no one. On the street, that is. Oh, I naturally assumed there must be homeless people around here someplace. I just simply couldn't see them here. 5 years later, when I began to see people at the tops of freeway exits with signs claiming to be homeless, often Vietnam vets, I remember my heart skipping a few beats. I had gotten used to not seeing the homeless. I'd gotten used to not being overwhelmed by all that sight. And suddenly I felt deeply uncomfortable seeing the clear evidence that in our state of Ohio, some have shelter and others do not. Some have advantages, others disadvantages. I saw these men with my biological eyes, with my glasses, certainly, or my contacts. My eyes work. But I found that the eyes of my heart wanted to remain blind. It was, after all, exhausting to see such things. It brought up my sense of being overwhelmed on the streets of Oakland day after day after day. I wanted to be blind to men with signs. I wanted to be blind to the reality of structural disadvantage in my very own society. But then I remembered all the stories I tell you every Sunday here during celebration, during worship, stories of our own deep religious heritage. I tell you stories every week. stories of sight coming to the blind, like this morning, or maybe stories of a whole bunch of people leaving Egypt in community, not alone. Stories of seeing with the wit and with the heart, as well as with the eyes. Stories of outrages confronted, named and transformed. Stories of abolition, of women getting the vote and getting into professions previously denied them. Stories of great marches on Washington. Stories of sacrifice and solace and sympathy. And because of these stories, my religious heritage places on my shoulders its healing hands. And I began to retract from my blindness. I began to heal from my denial. And so over the last 5 years, I've worked with several homeless people personally here in Columbus. Because I had to admit that what I see with my heart, I really see. I can't help everybody. I understand that. But in my seeing of two homeless people who I know by name, I found the call to seize my freedom to respond, not just for myself, but to others. I'm happy to say that those two homeless men I have worked with over the years now have a permanent address. Two is not 20, but two is good. It's okay. It's a beginning. Maybe considering the beginning of this sermon, I'd best think of this living religious tradition that I love as a set of lenses. As a pair of glasses, if you will, something which allows me to see more clearly, something which takes away the blurriness and the distortion. Just as when I was 4 years old and the trees looked blurry to me until I put on my new glasses. At least that's how I'd like to think of it. Oh, and by the way, if any of you see me in a trance one day, taking those glasses out to the backyard to bury them, shake me hard and wake me up, won't you?